Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on air. On this week's show, we talk about caring for someone with chronic kidney disease.
It's life-altering. It impacts the whole family dynamic. Many people get depressed. Many people just want to kind of give up.
Plus, gender reassignment surgery.
Most people really don't know or understand what it means to be transgender. We have learned a lot. We've had a very urgent and compelling reason to learn because our son's life depended on it.
And besides diet and exercise, what else might affect a college student's weight?
We know there are other factors. I mean, genetics is also a factor. But we're also finding other factors like sleep and eating competence that they might be contributing factors.
All that and a selection from our Healing Muse right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we examine how the complications following gender reassignment surgery can be successfully treated. Plus, beyond diet and exercise, what factors play a role in the freshman 15? But first, caring for someone with chronic kidney disease. Well, it's estimated that more than 10% of adults in the United States, that's more than 20 million people, may have chronic kidney disease, also known as CKD, which in the early stages is symptom-free, so many people may be unaware that they have it. Well, here with more on this and the challenges of living with CKD is Deb Palmentier, a registered nurse and the coordinator for the REACH program. She's the chronic kidney disease coordinator for the REACH program in Central New York. Welcome. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin, Deb, by explaining to our listeners, what exactly is chronic kidney disease?
Chronic kidney disease is when the kidney is not cleaning blood or getting rid of fluids like a healthy kidney would do. Chronic kidney disease has different stages. A lot of folks that have chronic kidney disease will never progress to the final stages of 4 or 5. But if they do, they have diminished kidney function, which means their kidney does not clean their blood. They're not able to get rid of fluids.
So the kidney has very important, basically a very important role in our bodies, keeping
does,
us healthy.
Yeah.
And basically what it does is remove
Removes fluids. And it removes toxins that a normal kidney would just filter everything that our body does not need. What happens if your kidney isn't working? It accumulates in your bloodstream. Those toxins accumulate, and it's usually only at that time when people become symptomatic or start to feel bad. This can go on for many years with just a general, you know, not feeling well. Most of the time they present to a physician and find out they're already in, let's say, stage 3 or 4 of kidney failure because it truly is, no symptoms. They really don't realize there's anything going on.
So you say there are lots of stages, but you're saying that during the time they're developing to more extreme stages, they may not even know they have this problem.
That's correct. That's why we recommend that they get screened. It's very easy to get screened if you have any kind of kidney disease. There's a simple blood test, a simple urine test, that values get measured, and early detection is the best way to deal with this disease.
And prevent further damage.
Yes, correct.
So who gets it? I mean, basically, what are the risk factors for people who get chronic kidney disease?
Diabetes is the number one cause of chronic kidney disease, with hypertension or high blood pressure right behind it. Certain ethnic groups are more prone to kidney disease. Really no reason why, but they are.
So African Americans are 3.5 times more likely to develop it?
Yes.
And how about Hispanics as well?
Their rate is also a higher level just because of their ethnicity. Age plays a factor. You know, once you hit 60, our body functions change, and that makes you a risk. If you have high blood pressure, certainly you're a risk.
cardiovascular disease also makes you, puts you at risk, or is it basically as a consequence of having the kidney disease?
It can be either or, to tell you the truth. So the main thing is, if you have one disease process going on, take care of that disease process so it doesn't progress to chronic kidney disease.
And when you, at the very greatest stage, or the last stage of chronic kidney disease, you're really in what they call end-stage renal failure, or end-stage renal disease.
Right.
Which means what?
Once you reach end-stage renal disease, that means you have less than about 14% of your kidney working. You either need to have a transplant, a kidney transplant, have dialysis, or unfortunately death will result.
So you really become completely dependent on dialysis for life if you end up with end-stage renal disease.
You do, and it's basically based on symptoms. You know, some folks might be at 13%, but they still feel okay. They're still doing all right. You know, we don't like to start dialysis until that person is really feeling, usually it's fatigue, kind of foggy because the toxins are building up, and just unable to maintain their daily activities, then is when we really recommend they start dialysis.
And generally, does it affect both kidneys simultaneously?
It can be either or. You know, as long as you have one kidney working greater than that 14%, you're okay.
Mm-hmm. And other issues that arise from this, as you said, people can have things like high blood pressure, pulmonary edema, some issues around their bones as well? What
yes.
happens with that?
The kidney deals with many, many other issues in our body than you like to think about. It plays a big role in anemia. The kidney has certain hormones that kind of tell our bone marrow to make more red blood cells. We lose red blood cells every day. When that kidney function diminishes, that signal doesn't get sent out. So many of the folks become highly anemic, which contributes to their fatigue. The other part is bone disease. Again, the kidney secretes hormones when it's functioning 100%. As that function diminishes, those hormones don't get secreted. So we have calcium and phosphorus imbalances in the bloodstream, which influences bone health. If the phosphorus increases, it makes our bones pretty soft, and multiple, you know, bone breaks, fractures, immobility just related to those levels can result.
So it's a pretty serious organ, pretty necessary for life, then the functioning of what it does by removing the toxins out of our blood. Is it your recommendation, when you mentioned that you can go unnoticed for many, many years, if people are getting regular checkups and their blood is being drawn in a routine physical with a primary care physician, is it likely that this will be picked up in an appropriate way?
Usually, and that's providing that you have, you know, your primary care physician. You go for that annual physical exam every year. If you do have diabetes or you do have high blood pressure, you know, we suggest that you speak with your primary care doc and say, you know, screen me, make sure my kidneys are working 100%.
So it's not necessarily routine as a part of an annual physical. You're saying it's mostly if you have these other conditions which might lead you to be more likely to develop it.
Certainly at that with that aspect, yes. But also, again, if they do a simple chemistry lab test that's usually done at your annual physical,
so it will show it.
Would give an indication that you may need to pursue.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with registered nurse Deb Palmentier, and we're talking about chronic kidney disease and the possible consequences. So once you've ended up with, let's say, chronic kidney disease or end-stage renal disease, and you require something like dialysis, that must be a great challenge for the lives of your life, your own life, and your family members. Tell us about that. What is it like, and how do people manage that?
It is. It's life-altering. It impacts the whole family dynamics. It really does make people many people get depressed. Many people just want to kind of give up.
And you're tied to a machine. How many times a day or how many times a week does someone have to go for dialysis to be sustained properly?
There's different options available for these folks. If you go to a center, it's 3 days a week for usually 4 hours. You know, and you have your treatment. If travel time may be involved for a lot of folks, so sometimes it's a day. It's a whole day where, you know, you're getting your treatment, and by the time you get home, it's dinner time. It's like having a full-time job, you know, plus taking your medications and you're on a restricted diet. It's very challenging for these folks.
So you are involved in this program called REACH. It stands for Real Engagement Achieving Complete Health. It's focused on chronic kidney disease, and you provide education within the community. Tell us a little bit about the program.
REACH was basically founded to assist and help these folks with chronic kidney disease cope with that disease. A lot of times what happens is they end up urgently in the hospital, getting a dialysis treatment, or having to make decisions when they're not feeling well, and these decisions can be life-changing. So if we can get to these folks earlier, in the earlier stages, and it may not even progress to dialysis, but the concept is to educate them and let them know what they can do. There's certain things they can do to prolong that life of their kidney, certain things to avoid. All possible, we try to help them avoid dialysis. If dialysis does happen, we guide them through that process because it is totally overwhelming.
I don't want to run out of time, but in the little bit of time we have left, what are the kinds of things you recommend to people to avoid ending up in dialysis? Or what are the kinds of things you recommend that they do to improve the health of their kidney?
To avoid dialysis, you know, you need to follow up with your physicians. You need to make those appointments. You need to take your medications. If you're a diabetic, you need to control that glucose, that A1C. You have to control that. You know, you have to somehow accept that you do have this disease, and sometimes that's the hardest part.
But basically, your role there, how do people find out about you? How do people come to you? Is it the kind of thing they go and have sessions to talk?
Yes. Any physician can refer. They do need a referral from their physician, whether it's their kidney doctor or their primary care doctor. It's free. It's individual sessions. You know, we get to know each individual, we come involved and try to help them plan what's good for them. What is their best choice? What works and best with their life?
It sounds to me like not many people probably know about your program, and you're saying it's free to the public. Who supports it?
It is. Dialysis Clinic Incorporated does, which is a not-for-profit dialysis clinic from Nashville, Tennessee. And we just started this program locally in October. So we're just getting the ball rolling with this, so we're trying to get the word out, but it's open to anybody in the area with chronic kidney disease.
Well, thank you so much for coming in and sharing that with me. It's very hopeful information, and I think people should know about it. My guest has been Deb Palmentier, a registered nurse and the REACH program, Chronic Kidney Disease Educational Program of Central New York. She's the coordinator for it. Thanks so much for coming in. Coming up next, the challenges of surgical care following gender reassignment surgery. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with you. With all the attention that Bruce Jenner's transition to Caitlyn Jenner caused recently, the issue of transgender identity has become a front and center issue of interest in this country. While the exact numbers of transgender individuals in the U.S. remains a rough estimate, data has suggested that there are approximately 700,000 of these individuals identifying themselves as transgender. And approximately 1 in 30,000 adult transgender males and 1 in 100,000 adult transgender females will seek sexual reassignment surgery. As complex and challenging as this surgery can be, there are also potential health issues that can arise following these procedures. Here with more on all of this is Dr. Dmitry Nikolovsky, Assistant Professor of Urology and the Director of Reconstructive Urology at Upstate Medical University. And joining us by telephone from Western New York is Terry Cook. She's the author of a new book called Allies and Angels and the Parent of a Transgender Child. Thank you both for coming in. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Linda.
So, Terry, let me start with you. When we start talking about transgender, it's still so new for so many people. Help us understand the circumstance of discovering that you are transgender and the kinds of concerns and how people begin to approach this idea of perhaps undertaking sexual reassignment surgery.
Sure. Thank you, Linda. Well, first of all, this was very new for my husband and I as well many years ago. If you had asked us several years ago what it means to be transgender, we couldn't have given you a good answer. My husband and I have two boys who are 20 and 24, but we didn't always know that we had two sons. For 15 years, I believed I was raising a daughter, and we've learned a lot, and we've unlearned a lot as to what this even means. You know, you mentioned the increased visibility with Caitlyn Jenner and others in the media. Even with that increased visibility, we're seeing most people really don't know or understand what it means to be transgender. And my husband and I, we have learned a lot. We've had a very urgent and compelling reason to learn because our son's life depended on it.
So in your experience, or in your experience now as an advocate and speaking to other parents and individuals, transgender individuals, what are some of the challenges early on in terms of both the individual, the transgender individual, and the families in terms of, you know, this whole issue of identity, sexual identity, or identity in general, and how they come to the decision to actually undergo some kind of surgical procedure?
Sure. Well, there was first, within our experience, and I don't speak for all transgender individuals or their families. This is our family's experience, and the experience is very broad and varied and different. In our family's situation, a good deal of the struggle and the challenge came to really even understanding that our child is transgender. It helps in this context to understand the difference between gender identity and sex, or assigned sex at birth. My child was assigned female at birth. I thought I had a daughter. And your sex refers to someone's body, the physiological and anatomical characteristics. When a child is born, the parents and doctor look between the legs and say, you know, you have a boy or you have a girl. That's the assigned sex at birth. Gender identity is a person's own understanding of who they are, of knowing whether they are male or female. It's gender identity is in your brain. It is an internal sense of knowing who we are. And for most of us, we sort of take that for granted, and gender and sex are sort of lumped together as one and the same. I always certainly did take it for granted. I was assigned female at birth. I always thought I was a woman and felt comfortable with that. But for a transgender individual, like my son, for example, was assigned female at birth, but he always felt that he was a boy. From his earliest memories, he always felt that he was a boy, but was not able to articulate that for us, to explain that to us. Gender identity is, children actually know their gender identity as young as 18 months to 3 years. Children know their gender identity. And we all have a gender identity. We all do. For most of us, it's aligned with our assigned sex, but not for transgender individuals.
Now, so what led, in your son's case, what led him to the point of the courage, perhaps, to undertake this kind of gender reassignment surgery?
Sure. Well, for my son, it wasn't until puberty, until his middle school years, that he was even able to articulate this, to come out and say, you know, I am a boy. This isn't something that just happened overnight. It took, there was a great deal of struggle, depression, anxiety, feeling that he didn't fit in, feeling that there was something that was not aligned within him, but not being able to articulate it. By the time he was able to actually communicate to us, and we were able to understand through many different doctors and therapists and professionals and specialists that our son actually is transgender, that our son is a boy, that he had a male brain inside what we thought was a female body. That was after several years of difficulty, anxiety, depression, struggling. So when the time came when we were all at that place of knowing that our child actually was a boy. I don't want to brush through that and make it sound as if, okay, one day our child came to us and said, I'm really a boy. And then we said, okay, well, let's move forward then. When we got to that point, transition is different for everyone. So our child, we understood, he had such dysphoria in his body. He had such moving through the world, being seen and perceived by others as a woman when he knew he was a man. His discomfort with his own body was very severe. He needed to make changes to be able to move through and live his life and move through the world as a man. He needed to make changes. And for him and for many people, those transition involves hormones and it involves surgery. It doesn't for everyone, but for the choices, what was necessary for him in consultation with the professionals we were working with and with my son. It was a long and difficult process. I'm reluctant to brush over it because many people ask me over the years, what kind of parent could allow their child to make permanent changes to their body with hormones and surgery? How could a child know? These were decisions to seek this care based on an extended period of time working with medical professionals on what he needs.
Okay, well, I'm going to just interrupt you for a minute because I want Dr. Nikolovsky to help us understand what takes place when we talk about gender reassignment surgery, just very briefly.
Thank you. So I personally don't do this big surgeries, at least not yet. I'm a urologist. I'm a reconstructive urologist that was trained in trauma, male reconstruction, female reconstruction, and I started here at Upstate in 2012 and really never was exposed to transgender reassignment surgeries.
But help us understand, I know you don't do that specific surgery at this point in time, and I know you're doing some help for those kinds of surgeries following them, but what actually takes place, just very briefly, in terms of female to male, male to female, what goes on?
So those professionals, those reconstructive surgeons that do this operation, at least in the United States and most of the world, they follow the guidelines of World Professional Association of Gender Health, and they publish the standards by which this process goes. So it starts with living in a new gender role for at least 1 year. Taking appropriate hormones, depending on which way the reassignment goes, for another year. They have to receive two letters of recommendation for surgery from mental health professionals, two independent letters recommending the surgery. And then usually it's done in a staged approach. First, the top surgeries are done, the breast surgeries are done, again, depending on
which direction,
and then finally, if patient desires, the very final step is the genital reconstruction, and there are many ways to do it.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with urologist Dr. Dmitry Nikolovsky, and actually author Terry Cook, who is also a parent of a transgender child. So let me get back to following this kind of surgery, Dr. Nikolovsky. There can be, I know you don't actually do the original surgery to make this gender reassignment take place, but there can be problems, not in every case, but in some cases, following this kind of surgery. Tell us briefly what those are.
I didn't know about these problems myself until the first patient came, and I was only 1 year after my fellowship, kind of settling in my reconstructive role here, seeing male reconstruction, female reconstruction. So the first patient comes and says, 3 months ago or 2 months ago, I just underwent the final surgery, the genital reconstruction, and it was in a faraway state. I'm local, and I think there were complications because I still can't urinate, so I immediately felt very, very uncomfortable because I never witnessed or experienced anything like this. I can see all kind of tubes sticking out, and I don't even know what to expect. So I had to go from known to unknown. This is our practice in reconstruction. You start where you know and move towards unknown territory. So I had to call the original surgeon, and it was very uncomfortable conversation on the phone. I don't want to be the guy that tells another surgeon, hey, you had a complication. So it was a kind of following a thin line, walking on eggshells to say, this is your patient. I'll take care of this patient. I think this is what needs to be done. He corrected me in many ways. He's a wonderful, wonderful surgeon, very skilled. And
so the bottom line, though, is that there are certain issues that do follow. What are the kinds of things that you found happen?
So I learned basically not from books, because there's almost nothing. There's nothing written in the books, and only a few articles are written in literature. I had to learn that there are potential several complications following this kind of surgery. It could be strictures, which is scar tissue built up around the seam lines of the reconstruction. That could be fistulas, which is leakage between the seam lines and outside the body. Could be abscess cavities. Could be, and usually it's a combination of two and up to six different things that could go wrong. But I have to say that these are minor complications compared to the amazing and very complex surgery that was done to begin with.
So the idea is that you were required in this circumstance, and as a result learned all about it, and now I think you're quite experienced. But the idea was you had to learn what were the potential complications, and they required additional surgical intervention, which you have successfully done now, it sounds like, in more than that initial patient. Is that
right,
correct?
Right, but that was the initial patient was the key, basically, first of all, to introduce me to the idea that these patients exist. I never even witnessed that these patients exist. Second, that the problems that they have are totally different from anything we learned in male reconstruction or female reconstruction. And when I try to apply what I knew, maybe in 70% of the cases, this extrapolation worked. But in 30% of the cases, I realized that we can't just apply what we know about male reconstruction and into reconstructing transgender urethra, for example.
So in fact, even though I think the existence of this kind of reassignment surgery dates back to even the 1930s, I understand initially, it's still very new and not being done in great, great numbers. And so the complications from this kind of surgery is very new to most urologists. But you have at this point developed a certain expertise in terms of making these kinds of corrections and helping these patients in terms of all kinds of urologic care following this kind of surgery. Am I correct? Whether they have a UTI or a urinary tract infection or something of that nature, you have become more knowledgeable and capable of following these types of patients.
This is correct. I believe that even if they don't have the complications, they still need to have continuing urologic care, because just like I was very uncomfortable seeing the first patient, I believe that any general urologist or even reconstructive urologist at this point would be unfamiliar with what they're dealing with. So I believe that they need to be, at this point, they need to be specialized centers for even continuing neurological care. Even simple things like UTI or retention or maybe even prostate checks in the future. I just don't see how a urologist that was not exposed to this kind of education would be comfortable taking care of this patient.
It is really kind of a sub specialty at this point. Let me turn back to you, Terry, in the little bit of time we have left. Did the reassignment surgery help with what you called the dysphoria, the gender dysphoria, and
What would you tell other parents now? What would your advice be to other parents in terms of not only undergoing this kind of surgery, but in being able to seek that kind of care that now Dr. Nikolovsky is prepared to offer?
Well, first, I want to commend Dr. Nikolovsky because as a parent and as an advocate, I have an understanding of the harsh realities of being transgender in our society and the disparities that exist in healthcare for transgender people. 19% report being refused medical care due to their gender identity or expression. And Dr. Nikolovsky, you can just tell in how he spoke, how he approached this his first patient and other patients and his care to learn and therefore support them. As a parent, I've watched my son grow from a depressed, struggling with anxiety, bullied, withdrawn, isolating individual to a young man who is now thriving in his life. He is a successful college student. He has held a full-time job. He is in a happy, healthy relationship. The changes, it's not just having his body aligned with his gender identity, but being able to live as he knows him, live as his true self, and move through the world. He is able to be his best self and is very successful, very happy, very healthy. And I don't know what more any parent could want for their child. I suggest all parents listen to their children, seek the care and support and help and resources that are available out there to be able to understand where their child is and what they need and how to best support them.
And part of it, as we just said, and I'm going to have to come to a close here, is that Dr. Nikolovsky, am I correct in saying that now you are able to see patients who are who have had transgender reassignment surgery following that and providing them with the kind of care that it sounds like they may well need in an ongoing fashion?
Yes, I think at this point I'm ready to announce that we will be offering the continued neurologic care in our reconstructive urology clinic. We are in contact with most of the original reconstructive and plastic surgeons that do this kind of operations. We have, over the last 3 years, developed long-distance friendships and referral patterns. Also, I found like-minded reconstructive individuals that do what I do. We have a tiny little network. We're all in contact with each other, and we learn from each other. This is a very exciting time of discovery and offering care to people that are underserved at this point.
Thank you so much. I want to thank you both so much for coming in, sharing both your stories, because obviously they were very, very personal for both Dr. Nikolovsky as an explorer in this area and for you, Terry, as a parent of a transgender child. My guests have been Dr. Dmitry Nikolovsky, Assistant Professor of Urology and the Director of Reconstructive Urology at Upstate Medical University, and Terry Cook. She's the author of a new book called Allies and Angels, and she is the parent of a transgender child. Once again, thank you both for coming in and sharing your compelling stories. Next up, beyond diet and exercise, what creates the freshman 15? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Students headed off to college, beware. The infamous freshman 15 is for real. Studies have shown that nearly 1 in 4 freshmen gain at least 5% of their body weight, an average of about 10 pounds, during their first semester. And that's just the beginning. Here to discuss this and the whys and wherefores of this problem is Dr. Tanya Horacek, a registered dietitian and professor of nutrition in the Department of Public Health Food Studies and Nutrition from Falk College at Syracuse University. Welcome, Dr. Horacek. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Linda. It's a pleasure to be here.
So the college students are really at risk for excessive weight gain, it seems. Tell us about that. Is this a real phenomenon?
It is. It is, unfortunately. College students are just like the rest of the American public, and that about 30% are right now overweight or obese, and that has increased over the past 10 years. And so they're on the same trajectory as all Americans in terms of their risk for weight gain.
But is there something unique either about that age group or about the experience of going away to college that may contribute? I mean, we're going to talk in more detail about what you found as far as contributing factors, but the mere fact that you're this whole idea of the freshman 15, what could be driving that?
Definitely, there are contributing factors, and they do gain a significant amount in those first couple of semesters. Part of it is the newness of being on your own, maneuvering the dining hall, going out, eating out, drinking, unfortunately. So there's quite a few factors that do contribute.
Yeah, people have often said it's the beer. Mm-hmm. Or the freedom that they now have mm-hmm. to drink whenever they want. I mean, I don't think it's quite that excessive. And also, do you think there's something about the meal plan or the fact that they can eat as much as they want in any given setting that plays a role there,
that,
too?
That is an adjustment. And unfortunately, most students say they don't like the dining hall when actually they have access to 500 different foods, a wonderful environment where they really could learn and taste a variety of things, but they fall into a habit of always going and eating what they like. And then they also do have access to high-calorie desserts and other foods that they could have at every meal if they wanted.
So I mentioned that there's usually about a 5% increase in their body weight in the first semester. Mm-hmm. What is the trajectory that they're engaged in at that point? Does it continue at that rate?
It does slow down. So we do see significant weight gain in the first year. It does level off. And then typically when they move off campus, it levels off a little bit. But
most of the time when you think about that kind of weight gain, as we talked about initially, we talked about the fact that they're exposed perhaps to more food or they may eat at odd hours, all those kinds mm-hmm. of things that could play a role. But people often, therefore, they think about diet, but then they also think about exercise or lack thereof. Are those the two still the most two crucial factors that play a role?
So how that's balancing out. They're pretty good with exercise. About 60% of college students are getting the minimum 150 minutes a week, but it might not be enough. There's a little bit of excess calories, really low in the fruits and vegetables. Only about 11% are meeting the 5 cups a day, so it's really low on the fruits and vegetables.
So it's the nature of what they're eating.
Yes, low whole grains, and now with the whole scare and all these current fad diets, they're not even eating carbs, so that's a contributing factor. Sugar-sweetened beverages, we see young men probably more so drinking the sodas, and young women, the coffee drinks. Those contribute. They all add up.
So in truth, that is still true, that it is diet and exercise.
That is the typical balance equation that we've looked at, and it does come back to a lot of that in versus out. But we know there are other factors. I mean, genetics is also a factor. But we're also finding other factors like sleep and eating competence, that they might be contributing factors.
Yeah, help us understand that. So when you say sleep,
okay.
What role does sleep play, either in hypothetically or in fact? Because I know you've done some research we'll talk about in a minute. What role does it play?
So sleep, we can look at total number of hours of sleep per night. And even with the adult population, the lower the number of hours of sleep, the higher likely you are to eat poor quality foods, higher body weight. Those associations.
So in essence, what you're saying is it's not the fact that the person is sleep deprived, but what sleep deprivation does is have them perhaps be less regulated in their food interests or in their appetite?
Partly. I mean, these are all associations. We don't actually always know causation, which one came first or second. But the other way we could look at sleep is also sleep quality. And one of the tools we use is the Pittsburgh Sleep Quality Index. And it measures 7 parameters. So one is your self-perception of the quality of your sleep. Another is latency, so how quickly you're able to fall asleep. Then it's duration, how long you actually sleep. Efficacy, so you're in bed, but how much of it are you actually sleeping? Sleep disturbances, waking up in the middle of the night or being woken up early in the morning. Need for medication use, sleep medications, and then finally, the effect the next day, the effects of sleep dysfunction. So if you're have overly sleepy or overly tired the next day. So each of those have an equal weighting that contribute to an overall sleep quality score.
So that's something you've used to try to evaluate if, in fact, college students are experiencing sleep issues.
Yes. Yep.
And what have you found?
We'll get to those in a minute. Let's talk about eating competence first.
Okay.
So eating competence is the other factor that, first of all, we are all born eating competent.
I would think so.
Yes. Yeah. That you cried when you were hungry. You kind of pushed the spoon away when you were full. It was mom's job to feed on a consistent schedule, offer a nice variety of foods. That was the basic role. And then the child's role is to actually decide what they want to eat and how much they want to eat.
And so, often it was a battle.
Right. Yeah.
Not in the very beginning, but over time it became, I would think, for a lot of parents,
right,
a battle. Eat your vegetables, rather than the sugary cereals or whatever.
So yes, there are influences that affect even eating competence. So we're born eating competent, and over time, because of diets, because of preferences, because of how we're raised and what we're given access to, you know, there's a decrease in eating competence. So eating competence is made up of four characteristics. And so this kind of balances out what we're eating.
So what are the characteristics that determine eating competence?
So one is eating attitude, and it's how flexible and open you are. You know, kind of getting away from the rules, that you really enjoy eating.
You mean you might be more adventuresome in terms of tasting things or trying things that you hadn't experienced before?
That might be part of it, yep. And then another is actual food acceptance. So the variety of the foods you like and your willingness to actually try new foods. So one is your whole overall attitude. Second is your willingness to try new foods. Then it's internal regulation. So how well we really pay attention to hunger and fullness. And now you don't have to always eat when you're hungry and always stop with your full, but you want to respect that.
So it's a little bit of like that mindfulness
exactly
around your satiety, whether you really are.
Mm-hmm.
You need that extra brownie after you've already eaten two.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And this has one more component to eating competence, and that's contextual skills. And it's not that you have to like have the perfect diet in mind, but it's how well you plan ahead, how well you're able to pick off a fast food menu or have cooking skills. It's the skills for managing eating. And sometimes we just don't have those.
So all of those four things together make for eating competence.
Yeah.
And in a second, we'll get to what that is. But if you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with Professor of Nutrition, Dr. Tanya Horacek. And we're talking about excessive weight gain that many college students experience and what has made that happen. So you've been studying these factors, whether it be eating competence, as well as sleep quality and duration, as well as the diet and exercise, for like over 20 years, mm-hmm, and all of their interconnectedness. So what have you found?
So one of our recent analysis, we did a multiple regression. And so the subjects that were overweight or obese, that was about 30% of the sample, they were more likely to be female, non-white, older age. Between the 18 and 24, we're talking about older in the college age years.
So 23 to 24,
right,
kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Lower sleep quality. So that comes back to the Pittsburgh Sleep Quality Index. And then lower eating competence and higher emotional eating. So those are all associations that we're seeing with higher weight. It's not causation, but we're seeing linkages that these factors are contributing or might be contributing to overweight and obesity.
So basically you're saying it's mostly women.
Mm-hmm.
And it's mostly white women, is that correct?
No, actually, not white women.
Mm-hmm. Non-white.
Right, non-white.
Okay, non-white women that are mostly overweight, and they're a little bit older age, mm-hmm, and they have sleep issues, and they have eating competence issues.
Right.
So how do you explain that? What hypotheses do you draw from this?
Good question. It's all interconnected. It really is all interconnected, how it's not just about the fruits and vegetables or the exercise. It's about the whole attitude of how we think about everything. So when they get caught up in the diet cycle and they're not really getting competent, everything contributes. You know, we're not really sure exactly how the sleep contributes, but we know sleep is an important factor to maintain a healthy body weight. So we're not sure exactly which comes first or second.
So you've been involved also in this process in the little bit of time we have left in doing interventions to try to change this whole scene. What have you found? What has worked with college students?
So they're a tough group. They're really a tough group because they're in the transition years. They don't really feel that they're at risk. And so our interventions have been challenging, to say the least. It's always been randomized treatment controls. They've always been 3-month interventions that they had online, access to online lessons. And then we would follow up a year later. And we were able to make small improvements, you know.
In terms of weight loss?
No, actually not. We never were really able to affect their anthropometric measures. It was more so slight changes in their fruit and vegetable intake, modest increases in physical activity, a little better sleep, and some of those things don't last the 15 months. And so they're really a very tough group to...
So they're intractable. They gain the weight and they stay that way?
It levels off. It levels off. But the problem is, you know, this is a very formidable time that they're learning habits that will carry with them into their adulthood, into their child-raising years, that we're really trying to help them, you know, set on a good
course. But are they any different? You said in the beginning as we started talking that this is really kind of equivalent to or a subset of what's happening in the larger population. And yet you're saying they're also a little bit perhaps more difficult to intervene with. What lessons can we take away from that, if any?
Well, because they are on the cusp, because it is a transition phase, we're so convinced that it's an important target that we need to continue to try to help. Because first of all, they're the next generation of parents, and this cycle is going to continue with, you know, low eating confidence and low levels of sleep and higher weight gain and leading to chronic diseases. So the more that we can do to really help this population, you know, not be so focused on the perfect diet, fruits, vegetables, and exercise, but to become more eating competent, to really accept a variety of foods and think about things a little bit more flexibly, to really try a variety of foods. You'd be surprised how limited the foods are the students like. It's a pretty narrow, short list.
So you would say that almost the greatest factor in all of this is to raise their eating competence, their ability to explore, be open to other kinds of foods, rather than to change their amount or their exercise or any of that. You think that's the biggest factor?
I think that overriding factor is going to make the biggest difference. Improving the fruits and vegetables will follow. Improving the exercise will follow. You want to balance out. All of these are interconnected. And so if we can improve the eating competence,
broaden their awareness of and receptivity to different types of food.
Mm-hmm. And their contextual skills, you know, how well they are able to fend for themselves.
Take care of themselves, mm-hmm. cook for themselves, mm-hmm. produce, if not produce, then prepare their own meals and that kind
of
thing.
Right. And then the sleep also.
And improve their sleep habits as well.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for coming in. This is very interesting research, and I'm sure that you'll continue. Obviously, they're a group that need to continue to be studied.
Exactly.
And if only as the bellwether, as you've said, to what else is going on in our society.
Right.
Very good. Well, thanks so much for coming in and sharing your information. My guest has been Dr. Tanya Horacek, a registered dietitian, professor of nutrition in the Department of Public Health Food Studies and Nutrition for the Fall College at Syracuse University. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Andrew Shep is a pastor, a poet, and a singer. He also volunteers as a chaplain in the hospital. He gives us a glimpse into the divine that constitutes the workers in the hospital in his poem, "This Time I'm in the Hospital as a Volunteer." And those are angels, drifting in and out of rooms, repairing what the world has damaged. I could tell you how frightened the angels are, how they need to find a brave face for the sake of the dying, and disguise every wince at the bearing of brokenness. Hotel Dieu, the French would call this place, God's hotel. They're on to something. Only God, with skills honed suspending the heavy bodies of planets and stars in heaven's huge and weightless black, where each, seen from a certain angle, can be said to occupy the center. Who but God could house such a constellation of life in this city of mansions? Heaven will be here till the earth no longer needs it. I could tell you how the angels will rummage through the eyes of people trapped in broken bodies and broken minds and rejoice with relief at the glimpse of a God whose face they might otherwise never see beyond the walls of their wings.
Thank you for joining us for HealthLink On Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Please join us again next week when we examine a new treatment for adrenal gland tumors. We'll take a closer look at Lyme disease and explore the essential ingredients in nutrition for the older adult. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on iTunes. Just search for HealthLink On Air, that's all one word. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, or you can check up the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks so much for listening.